Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers' Festival. You're listening to a podcast recorded live at the 2019 Festival.
Thank you so much. Hello, if you're watching outside of Sydney. What a pleasure to be here this morning and not have to talk about politics at all. Thank you very much for coming to listen to me talk about Any Ordinary Day. I've been a journalist for 25 years and I have reported every kind of scandal and every kind of story that you could imagine. Cyclones, floods, political upheaval, sporting scandals, criminal cases, you name it. I've seen human beings face every kind of challenge that life can throw at them, and I've seen all of the different kinds of ways that they respond. And this morning I want to tell you the main thing that reporting all of that has taught me. It's that the day that turns a life upside down usually starts just like any other. You open your eyes, swing your body out of bed, eat breakfast, get dressed, and leave the house, your mind busy. You close the front door behind you, and rarely is there a tingle of unease that something is off. And later, when the story of what happened next comes to be told, it will start with the day's deceptive ordinariness, something that will now seem inconceivable. In late 2014, I anchored two stories on my program 7:30 that were about events that happened on days that began in the most ordinary ways imaginable, but were so inconceivable in the way that they ended that they rattled every one of us. On the afternoon of November the 25th, a flawless spring day, a young cricketer, Philip Hughes, was fatally struck in the head by a ball during a game. And on the morning of December the 15th, at morning tea time in a Sydney cafe, a gunman took 18 people hostage, and two of them, Katrina Dawson and Tory Johnson, were killed by the siege's end. Philip Hughes padded up as he'd done since childhood. Katrina Dawson left her law office to pop downstairs to grab a hot chocolate with a friend. Tory Johnson was just going about his business on a regular day at work. It feels as if the universe cheated them by not warning that this was a day to stay home. This was not the ordinary day that it appeared to be at all. It was going to be a life-changing day. And if the universe or fate, luck, God, happenstance, whatever you want to call it, didn't give them that courtesy, then it probably won't offer it to you or to me either. There are many choices that we make in life in the full knowledge that they will alter the course of our lives, whether to marry or have children or change jobs or move country. We expect those kind of decisions to have consequences. We're privileged to live in a country that affords us choices. We're extraordinarily privileged that we've been not born, as so many people are around the world, into lives that begin tragically, stay tragic, and end tragically. But nonetheless, for most of us who live pretty comfortable middle-class lives, the fact remains that sometimes our lives can be completely upended by reasons well outside our control. The confronting thing about the cricket accident and the Lindt Cafe siege and many other stories that I've covered over the years was that the choices leading to disaster were so minor that they were barely worth contemplation. What family could possibly imagine that a choice about whether to send their little boy to soccer or cricket is actually a choice about how long he'll live? Who could possibly function if they had to wonder every day if having a hot chocolate with a friend was a matter of life or death? Who could possibly wonder if coming to a big gathering like this was going to be the day that profoundly changed your life forever? We each make similar choices without pause every moment of every day, blessedly oblivious to where they might lead. I see every day of my working life that these kind of blindsides level the rich and the poor, the weak and the powerful, without discrimination. It would be unusual for any one of us in this room to escape life without one. The only thing that usually varies is the difference in scale. You know, not everybody lands on the news when their life is suddenly turned upside down. But nonetheless, almost every human being will at some point have that experience and never see it coming, be blindsided. Are you, for example, in the last days right now of what you will later come to think of as normal life? It's straightforward to grasp the idea intellectually that life can change in an instant, but it's deeply uncomfortable emotionally to be prodded with the sharpness of the reality. And for me, the news stories that dominated the media cycle in the second half of 2014 magnified the deepest truth of being alive, a fact that is wonderful and terrible all at the same time. We never know what's coming next. I know rationally that the news is not a mirror held up to life. It's highly selective. As one of my journalism lecturers told my class, 99 helicopters will fly completely safely today, but it's the one that doesn't that makes the news. Even so, reporting awful events for hours every day has made me quite fearful and anxious. In December 2014, after Philip Hughes and the Lindt siege, I often lay awake at night at the thought of all the people who had recently found themselves in the news when their everyday lives had been suddenly upended. I found it hard to contemplate the questions that those tragedies raised. Questions like, why them? Why not me? Why not somebody I love? When is it going to be my turn? It has to be my turn at some point. Until 2014, I'd lived a life that was largely free of trial and trauma. I would have said that I was a resilient person, but really nothing had happened that would test my resilience to any great degree. In 2014, my personal life really basically blew up, and then I really did have to learn what resilience was. This birth of my second child in February that year was very traumatic. I had a life-threatening complication and woke up in a high-dependency unit with the baby in neonatal intensive care with possible brain damage. I'd had 3 blood transfusions. I had tubes coming out of every conceivable space. I didn't even see the baby for another 3 days. When we finally went home, we were back at hospital again 6 weeks later as the baby contracted viral meningitis. We were told, look, we'll have to wait to see how he develops. You have to prepare for the worst because he's had 2 serious brain traumas in the first 6 weeks of life. It's not very good. 2 weeks after getting out of hospital with the meningitis situation, my older son's daycare, who was 2 at the time, called us to come in as they'd noticed a tremor in his hands, and they were concerned that something wasn't right with his health. And that's been years of challenges for him. And then in the middle of all of that, my marriage of 20 years started to unravel and ultimately ended. I should reassure you that my little boy is fine and he didn't suffer any long-term brain damage. But at that time, in 2014, what lay ahead was all unknown. In the days after his birth, when I was very unwell and he was in intensive care, I had a dream, and amidst all of the things that have happened to me, it probably remains the single worst moment. In the dream, I was in a mansion and I was in labour and I couldn't find anywhere to give birth and nobody would help me. The sound of my own voice in real life in my hospital bed woke me up. I had tears pouring down my cheeks and I was crying, mummy, mummy, mummy. I was a 40-year-old woman and I was crying for my mummy. The reason that was such a horrifying moment for me was because it shattered my sense of who I was. My own mother had rung that very day to ask if she should come down from Queensland, and I said, no, I can manage. I don't want to be a bother. I've never called my own mother mummy. I have never called her mummy. I call her mum. It was profoundly disturbing to me to see that I could be reduced to this childlike state, crying for my mummy. It was horrifying to me. And what I learnt from that dream was that my sense of security in the world had been shattered, because I thought that I was this competent, independent person who could handle anything, but I wasn't. The experience changed me profoundly, and the view of my life from the other side of that couple of weeks in hospital was not the same as my view of it from before. The world did not seem as safe as it once had, and the possibility of death or catastrophe seemed real, not like distant things that I didn't need to worry about for the time being. When things kept going wrong, I thought, oh, right, okay, so now my luck has run out. I'm one of those people now. I'm one of those people for whom things keep going wrong. I thought, as lots of people do, why is this happening to me? I'm a good person. Why is all of this happening? Over time, my own personal experience amplified the questions with which the news confronts me every night. How do we come to terms with the fact that life can blindside us in an instant? When the unthinkable does happen, what comes next? You know, how do you actually go on when you're suffering great pain and challenges that you don't know how they're going to work out? Do we as a community have a responsibility to people who unwittingly find themselves in the middle of a story that we all want to know more about? And once we truly understand that we are not exceptional, but are instead as vulnerable as the next person, what does that tell us about how we should live? All of us will experience grief and suffering because it's part of the human package. And I dread the anticipated losses of life, such as the death of my mother or friends or the slow decline of age. But those things don't terrify me as much as the prospect of something unexpected that turns life upside down instantly. I've been scared of it my whole career because my career has confronted me with it all the time. I've tried to avoid watching stories like that on my own program. I've preferred to cover politics for most of my career rather than general news, so I could avoid having to think about that kind of thing too much. What prompted me to begin writing Any Ordinary Day was the thought of what might happen if I walked towards what I most feared rather than in the opposite direction. What would I learn if I spent time with people who had lived through some of the things I'm most worried about happening to me or to my family? And what if I talked to them 1 year on, 5 years on, 20 years on from these events? What could the newest scientific research teach me about the way the human brain comes to terms with these kinds of blindsides? It felt to me like staring at the sun. It scared me to do it. I knew it would be painful, but I wanted to see what would happen if I didn't look away. During the writing of Any Ordinary Day, I met some incredible people, some of whom you will have heard of and some of whom you won't. People shared the most extraordinarily intimate details of their lives with me. I really think that they're some of the best interviews that I've ever done. But it's not a book that's a series of stories. It's more a book about exploring the questions that I've outlined above and what it's taught me personally about how to deal with the fact that life can suddenly change for the worse and to sit more comfortably with the idea and the fact that almost certainly tragedy will come for me and for all of us one day. I thought that it could be and feared that it would be a depressing experience, but it was actually profoundly uplifting, and it has given me a lot of hope to see how people endure what life throws at them and to see the kindness in the world that allows people to go on. One of the loveliest things too was seeing how in the midst of awful things people can still find humour. Even in the publicity tour for the book, I had to do some commercial FM breakfast radio, and I was thinking, this is really tough subject matter for a light program. I was doing a breakfast radio in Melbourne with Chrissy Swan and Sam Pang and Jonathan Brown. And they had a comedian on the show, and there aren't many laughs to be had in this subject matter, but this young guy goes to me, one of the people you talk to, Stuart Diver, he's the sole survivor of the Thredbo landslide, and you talk to him about some of the worst days of his life. I was wondering if one of them was the day that he learned that Craig McLaughlin was playing him in the miniseries. For me, one of the most fascinating things I had the chance to look at was the cutting-edge psychological research into why we think like we do about the kind of blind sides that we see on the news. So why, for example, when we see something like the Lindt Cafe siege, do we think, oh, that could have been me? Or when there's a tragedy like that Dreamworld roller coaster accident that just horrifically killed four people, do we think, oh, I'll never go on a ride like that ever again, even though we take statistically more significant risks every day, for example, by driving in our own cars? Or why does something like the death of Philip Hughes rattle the whole community, even though we don't personally know him, and even though chances are we don't play cricket or know anyone who plays cricket at the kind of level where we could be fatally struck in the head by a ball? There's amazing research out there that answers all of these kinds of questions. For all of recorded time, human beings have been fascinated by the intersection of destiny and chance, and we've craved ways to tame and test the fates. We hate to feel vulnerable and we seek reassurance any way that we can. So we read horoscopes, pray to gods, visit clairvoyants, check the weather forecasts. We scour news stories about our risk of contracting various diseases so we can take the necessary precautions against them. Gambling can be dated back to 3500 BC, thanks to an ancient form of dice uncovered during an archaeological dig in Egypt. And gamblers, along with other people whose jobs involve precision or luck or high risk, such as sports stars, actors, sailors, soldiers, frequently turn to superstitious rituals for protection to allow them to do their work. It's not just them either. I can't tell you how many times I've approached a red traffic light and thought something like, okay, if it turns green before I stop the car, then I will land the Prime Minister for an interview tonight. If I end up stopping the car, okay, best of three. We all do that every day. We ascribe significance to the most meaningless random events so as to give ourselves a sense of control over our world and the uncontrollable things in our world. Human brains have evolved to need predictability. Our ancient ancestors had to make dozens of decisions every day that went to their very survival. You know, what food was good to eat, what shelter would offer the best protection from the elements, what locations were safe from predators. Predictability was useful because it streamlined the decision-making process. So, for example, if a plant had been safely eaten before, then it could be safely eaten again. So the need for predictability was so strong that evolutionary biology has caused our brains to permanently prefer it. The brain gathers all sorts of data from the outside world and stores it as memories. And memories then help us make decisions about how to act by evaluating past experience against present reality. That mental process can occur in a split second for something like picking up a glass and drinking from it, but it can be a lot more tortuous for complicated decisions such as whether another person is trustworthy. The brain loves patterns it can recognise because they foster predictability in the world around us and help us eliminate unpleasant feelings of insecurity or unfamiliarity. Lots of scientific experiments have demonstrated the brain's preference for predictability over unpredictability. In one study, monkeys were given a choice of two coloured targets, both of which came with rewards, but only one of which allowed the monkeys to see what the reward was that was going to come down the tube. And after a few days of training, the monkeys showed a clear preference for the target where they could see what they were going to receive. In another experiment, humans were found to prefer receiving a guaranteed small electric shock over sitting with the uncertainty that they might or might not get an electric shock. They would rather push the button that gave the guaranteed electric shock than the button that might or might not shock them. In other words, people feel better about knowing what is coming, even if it's painful, than not knowing, because we feel that we can brace ourselves. There's also a chemical reason for this preference for certainty and predictability, as well as a biological one. When our brains receive information that makes sense to us, they behave in the same way as when we reward any other craving, which is by releasing dopamine, a chemical that makes us feel pleasure. So when dopamine's produced, the body feels calm, content, relaxed, satisfied, comfortable, relieved, and safe. By contrast, uncertainty is closer on the spectrum to pain, and so the body tries to avoid it. We've all, of course, have our subjective levels as to how much certainty or uncertainty we like to predict, but overall we like predictability. The human bias towards predictability makes us look for cause and effect in the world around us, even for things that defy easy explanation. We still want an explanation. You know, why did somebody change their plans at the last minute, which meant that they weren't at the Lindt Cafe when they were meant to be there, for example? We often think, oh, well, it must have happened for a reason. The idea that everything happens for a reason is a reassuring thought, as if somewhere out there is a blueprint dictating the course of our lives, even if we can't see it. There's a greater sense of certainty in believing that things are under some form of control, whether our own or somebody else's. And for many people, it's more comforting to believe that factors such as how hard we work, the choices we make, or the goodness of our deeds influence our destiny more than just straight luck and chance do. Does this kind of thinking square with the evidence, though? Many life-changing events, and even just arbitrary ones, like, say, us being here today, are arbitrary. The 18 people in the Lindt Cafe didn't do something that meant that they deserved to be there, while you or I did not. The brain wants an explanation for why it happened and why those people were there so it can satisfy its desire for cause and effect. And something like the Lindt Cafe shatters our sense of individual security, because how do we know that we won't be in a public location when a terrorist attack occurs? And the brain desperately wants our feeling of security restored. Most unusual events, like being the victim of a terrorist attack, can be at least partially explained thanks to a mathematical theory called the law of large numbers. When you take a group of people, which is called a sample, when that's an enormous group of people, an enormous sample, the chance of an extremely rare event occurring is greatly magnified. So a 1 in a million chance of something happening to you looks very, very rare on a piece of paper. Yet Australia's population is nearly 25 million. So if every year just a single 1 in a million event happens in Australia, 25 Australians are that person. The law of large numbers explains why something that might feel highly significant to you personally may not in fact be that unique when you look at it in the context of the sample. So say you dreamt that a friend died, and the next day you found out that friend had indeed passed away. You would no doubt find that coincidence highly memorable and think that it signified something. Yet in 2003, a British statistician calculated the odds of dreaming about a friend's death on the night it actually happens. He based his maths on Britain's population at the time, which was 55 million, which is a gigantic sample, and assumed an average of one dream of a friend's death per lifetime. And he then factored in the national death rate of 2,000 people every 24 hours. Crunching those numbers, the odds of an accurate death dream in Britain are 1 every 2 weeks. Given the size of the global population, which is 7.5 billion, the law of large numbers means that weird coincidences like that or Lindt Cafe type events are actually sadly common. What it doesn't mean is that we are more likely to be caught in one ourselves. Our planet is the ultimate large sample. With so many of us, one individual's chance of being the victim of the kind of blindside that lands on the news is still small. Our brains make the prospect seem more likely and more scary than it really is because they're putting the unusual events, the ones that defy past patterns and predictability and that we therefore are programmed to see as threatening, it's putting those into neon lights because we view them as dangerous. If the chance of an awful random disaster affecting us personally is remote, then why are we so rattled by them and why do we worry so much about them happening to us? As with the brain's preference for predictability, the answer lies with evolutionary biology, which, along with our personal experience in life, is the reason that we often draw the conclusions that we do. Until about a millisecond ago in the span of human history, we lived together in small tribes and we stayed with the same people from birth to death. Our ancestors faced potentially catastrophic threats from things that are no longer much of a danger to most of us living in the modern world. Snakes, spiders, large cats and other predators, darkness, being alone, being separated from the tribe, being in an open space. Over many centuries, humans have evolved to internalise the fear of those things. Those are still some of the most common fears today. Our ancestors had great cause to fear situations which could claim many lives at once and possibly wipe out most of a tribe's population. Safety was in numbers and survival improved with the size of the tribe. New threats, or those that hadn't been previously experienced, were also particularly terrifying because the tribe couldn't prepare a response. So humans living today are genetically programmed through evolution to fear blindsides that you can't see coming and to fear disasters that result in mass casualties. By looking at this way that our brains have evolved, scientists and psychologists have been able to map many of our common fears according to what they call dread risk. So an event that is uncontrollable, unfamiliar, unimaginable, causes huge suffering or leads to simultaneous fatalities and large-scale destruction is said to have high dread risk. So events with high dread risk are things like a chemical weapons attack, terrorism, or a gun massacre. Low dread risk events are just the opposite. So they would be things like deaths from smoking or falling from a ladder. Thanks to biology, events with a high dread risk scare us much more than those with a low dread risk, even though the low are statistically more likely to cause death or injury. We know the dangers of smoking and using a ladder in an unsafe way, so they feel like things we can control, unlike the question of when or where somebody might start shooting with a gun or a terrorist might detonate a bomb. The high dread risk of situations that claim many lives at once versus the low dread risk of things that claim more deaths but spread over time is why many of us are more scared of the plane flight than of the drive to the airport, even though the latter is statistically by far the greater danger. It's what makes nuclear accidents more gut-churning than obesity, even though obesity is far more dangerous to most of us. We watch an event like the Lindt Cafe on the news and we feel particularly scared and vulnerable, even though the more probable risk to our personal longevity is whatever we're eating while we watch the TV. Our reaction is due to the ancient threats that our ancestors faced and the way that we're wired to think as a result. As well as some of that, what I found absolutely fascinating psychological research, I want to tell you briefly about some of the incredible people I met in the writing of this book. One of the things that I wanted to do was to ask the questions that we all want to ask, but that we feel would be just socially inappropriate to ask or too awkward, or that we would fear hurting somebody. For example, when somebody has lost their entire family, what stops them from killing themselves? When you arrive home from work and the police are at your house to tell you that your husband's been killed, like, what happens next? What do they say? What do they hang around? Do they come in? How long do they hang around for? How do they break that news? And then what if you're the police officer who has that job? What is that like for you on that tiny detailed level? Do you have a game plan? How do people react when you show up with that kind of news? Is there any sort of common human pattern? Often I would meet a person and they would say that when some dreadful blindside had happened to them, it felt like they had been plonked into a foreign land. And in that foreign land, they would sometimes meet people and cling to them because these people seemed to speak the language in this land and were extremely helpful. And then I would track down those people too and talk to them. One person that I met who was fascinating is the person that I described to you before, the policeman who had to go to people's houses. He was a detective with the New South Wales Homicide Squad. He had frequently had to go to people's houses and tell them that a loved one had been killed. His name was Graham Norris. I'd interviewed a woman named Juliet Darling whose partner, Nick Waterlow, had been murdered by his schizophrenic son. The murderer then went on the run and Graham Norris was involved in the manhunt, and then he was involved in the trial and the coronial inquest when the man was apprehended. Graham Norris was one of the most fascinating people I've ever met. I could not imagine doing his job for a second. He was tall with a shaved head. He had a very bushy grey beard that reminded me of a bushranger in the 1800s. He had a very broad Australian accent, a straightforward way of speaking, and a larrikin sense of humour. He told me about his old boss in the homicide squad, the amusingly named, and I might add, highly respected, Inspector Hans Rupp. Get it? Hans Rupp. Rupp kept showing up at a daily briefing during a large-scale manhunt during a double homicide, declaring, "I'm 100% certain the suspect is dead. We just have to find the body. It's going to be a suicide." Until one day, the suspect was sighted withdrawing cash at an ATM. And when Rupp arrived at that day's briefing, he opened with, "Right, I'm fairly certain the suspect is alive." Graham was a late starter in the police. He joined the force in 1997 at the age of 35 after a career in sales. He'd always wanted to be a policeman but had not done it because his parents thought it was a dangerous job, and so he'd taken a different path to keep them happy. But over time, he couldn't let the dream go, and so thinking better late than never, he went to the New South Wales Police Academy. His first assignment after graduation was general duties at the police station at Mount Druitt, which is a fairly depressed area in Sydney's southwest. He said it was the happiest he'd ever been. He loved the variety, he loved the intensity, and then he ended up in sex crimes and then after that, homicide. I asked him if before he went to homicide, if he was scared about things like being around dead bodies. And he said he was mostly apprehensive about having to watch post-mortems because he tended to get queasy whenever he had to get a needle, which of course made me think, my God, massive court, go to homicide. But he said he got around that because he thought that the work was meaningful and important, and he knew that as a human being he had the capacity to do it, and he knew that not everybody did have that capacity. I asked him what it was like to go and tell a family member that somebody had been killed. He said it was always really difficult. You never really got used to it. He called it delivering a death message. He said that you get trained for it at the police academy, but that you mostly learn to do through what to do through experience and being on the job. So he had learned, he said, for example, that you have to be very, very direct when delivering that kind of news, because the human brain will try to avoid dealing with the reality of it. So if you say to somebody, "I'm sorry, your son's been in a fatal car accident," a lot of people will say, "Is he okay?" or "Who died?" You have to say, "I'm sorry, there's been a fatal car accident. Your son has been killed." He said, it's so hard to do it. You never want to say the words. You're always afraid when you give the news how the person will respond. But he said, there's no predictability. He said one time he went to somebody's house and he said, "I'm sorry, your father's been killed." And the person said, "That's the best news I've ever had. Would you like to come in for a coffee?" Graham, of course, was like, "No." I thought that Graham had the most incredibly emotionally intelligent approach to his job. When he was walking from somebody's car to their front door, and he knew on his side of the door that he was about to change their life forever, that they, as they were walking to the door, didn't know that yet, he had a principle that would guide him. It was the idea that he was going to be the first person who was going to have to help this other person adapt to their new normal yet. They would want their old life back, but they would never be able to get it back. And he would have to try to help them adapt to their new normal. He would say to them, not on that first occasion, but after a period of time, because often his involvement with this person was long and drawn out and involved investigations and court cases and so forth. After a time, he would say to them, "We have to try to find a way for you to make a life with this new set of circumstances." I'll tell you exactly what he said to me, because I just thought it revealed what an amazing person he was. He said, "This is a long process they're entering into. The legal process is going to be counted in years, not months. And for them, it's a lifetime of change. I always felt a strong responsibility, a heavy responsibility, to look after these people. You'd love to be able to say, 'I'm going to get you the outcome that you want. You'll be happy at the end of all of this,' but that just doesn't happen. So if the person I'm looking after, if we get to the end of whatever process and it's not the outcome they wanted or expected, they might feel disappointed in that, but at least they won't feel disappointed in the way that I've looked after them." Somebody else with whom I spent time who left a lasting impression was Stuart Diver, the sole survivor of the Thredbo landslide in 1996, arguably the most famous disaster survivor in Australian history. His wife, Sally, died right in front of him. And you might think that that was Stuart's allotment of tragedy for his lifetime, but sadly, Stuart's second wife, Rosanna, died of breast cancer. So he's slightly older than I am, but has been widowed twice. Stuart helped me learn how people adapt to horrendous blindsides. When any person faces something like that, they will usually initially fall apart. But eventually, and incredibly, a majority of people do adapt to their new normal, as Graham Norris put it. Just how long they stay in the first phase of dysfunction and then how well they adapt during the second differs enormously from person to person. You know, why do some people seem to remain fractured for a long time, whereas others seem to fairly rapidly return to basic functioning? What are the factors that make adaptation more likely? It seems to me from what I studied that the things that influence how well we adjust to a game changer can be divided into three groups: the nature of the event itself, our genetics, and our internal belief about the way the world works, which is formed largely through our personal history. That the nature of the event itself dictates how well a person recovers seems self-evident. Stuart Diver's experiences proved that point. He told me that there was no comparison between watching his first wife suddenly die in front of him in shocking circumstances with the death of his second wife, for which he'd had time to prepare and which was much slower to unfold. Many events in life are difficult to process, but some of them, such as the death of a child or witnessing the violent death of a loved one, are particularly confronting. An event in which a person's own life is suddenly and seriously threatened is also very devastating. Beyond the event itself, our biology and the character traits we inherit from our parents account for about 40 to 50% of how well or otherwise we adapt to adversity. Stuart said to me, "You can ask people who knew me before, you can ask my family and friends, they'll tell you I'm the same person." He's probably right. The fact is that he probably was a fairly resilient, determined and positive person, and those qualities would have helped him enormously in coming to terms with his tragedies. The personality traits associated with recovery include optimism, extroversion, hardiness, and a healthy ego. Optimists, for example, are more likely to be able to make meaning of an awful event by concentrating on the good that might come from it. Being optimistic is linked with positive outcomes in numerous studies of affliction, including cancer, heart disease, rheumatic disorders, and HIV. The research around this is so overwhelming that it perhaps explains why we seem to live under this tiresome tyranny of positive thinking, as if optimism itself is a miracle cure and not just a coping tool. Telling people to think positive if they're not so inclined is actually potentially harmful because it can lead to feelings of failure or to repression. One influential theory about adaptation is that we're all born with a fixed level of emotional equilibrium and happiness called a set point. And it's kind of like an internal spirit level. So good or bad fortune makes it fluctuate in the short term, but over time it returns to its original level. In a famous 1978 study on this subject, researchers compared three groups of people: a control group, a group of lotto winners, and a group of people who'd recently suffered devastating spinal injuries. Short term, winning the lotto was definitely a big boost, and losing mobility was obviously devastating. But after a year, things had changed. The lotto winners were not significantly happier than the control group. The spinal cord injuries were less happy than both the control group and the lotto winners, but nowhere near as unhappy as they had been straight after their accidents. In 2013, the study was replicated with different groups of people, but with one important change. It looked at people not 1 year later, but 20 years later. And over the decades, all three groups had adapted to their changed circumstances and weren't any more or less unhappy on average than each other. Since that 1978 set point study and the follow-up, psychologists have raised questions about whether our equilibrium really is as fixed as that. A German study monitored 40,000 people for 21 years, and a British one followed 27,000 people for 14 years. Charting a huge group of people for a long period of time allowed researchers to scrutinise the impacts of all sorts of major life events: divorce, death, unemployment, loss of children, the onset of disabilities. Some people did find their set points enhanced or depressed permanently, and it's an area that's ripe for future research. Along with Stuart Diver's personality, he said another thing during our interview that's key to understanding the process of adaptation. Stuart said that with the help of a therapist, he worked out that before the landslide, he had 13 or 16 fundamental beliefs, core assumptions about the way the world works. All of us, consciously or unconsciously, hold these beliefs. They're called schemas, and they differ for each one of us. They form in our earliest years through our personal experience and through what adults teach us. A devastating event smashes a person's schemas, kind of like a mental car crash. And sometimes the schemas are pieced back together again, and sometimes they're destroyed and replaced by something else. One person holds many different schemas covering beliefs about justice, control, predictability, spirituality, and self-esteem. They include beliefs like things work out for the best, things happen for a reason, hard work pays off, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. The most common schemas can be classified into three categories. The first is about the benevolence of the world, notions like if you're a good person, good things will come to you, or love will ultimately triumph over hate. The second covers how the external world works, such as people get what's coming to them, or your fate is set from birth. The third is about self-esteem, and it might include ideas such as I must be a bad person because bad things always happen to me, or I've worked hard so I'll achieve my dreams. Schemas, whether you're aware of yours or not, powerfully influence your thoughts, actions, and behaviour. They're the filter through which you interpret other people's behaviour and help you decide how to act with friends and strangers. They help you anticipate and plan for the future, and they even govern what you notice and remember when new information comes along. We pay more attention to things that reinforce our schemas, and we downplay or negate incoming data that conflicts with them, something known as confirmation bias. Confirmation bias helps us remain emotionally and mentally stable. As I explained earlier, humans are designed to want cause and effect, and we need explanations for why things happen so our brain can move on to thinking about something else. The more something fits with our existing schemas, the easier it is for us to file away. A sudden life-changing event or watching something like, say, the Lindt Cafe on the news is emotionally destructive because it shatters schemas and it stops the brain from knowing how to understand or interpret the world. Life may seem confusing. I was just going for a coffee and this awful thing happened. How could something so awful happen to my child? What did I do to deserve this? When schemas are upended, the brain responds in one of three ways. It can go into denial, shutting down, repressing reaction, and refusing to attempt to process what happened. Denial can actually be a very useful short-term coping mechanism because it's protective. Our brain can assimilate, finding a way to integrate what has happened into our schemas. This happened to Stuart Diver as he trained himself to think of his final moments with his first wife, Sally, as evidence that he was somebody who cared about other people under the greatest possible stress, which was one of his core beliefs, because even under the most trying of situations, he attempted to save her life. So he was allowed, instead of thinking about that event as I was powerless, I couldn't save her, he turned it around to be thinking I did everything I could to save her and I tried to care for her right until the very end. The third way is accommodation. This is when a person fundamentally changes a core belief about the way the world works. You might, for example, no longer believe that what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. You might actually feel weaker after what you've been through. The more successfully a person is able to accommodate or assimilate, the better they will be able to adapt to a blind side and move forward. An attempt to make a tragedy fit with our schemas is one of the reasons that we almost always ask, why me, after something awful happens to us? And this is, in fact, a profoundly important question because it's the first step in allowing the brain to process an event. There are literally dozens of studies cataloguing how many people ask themselves, why me, after a traumatic incident. It's almost universal, and what impact the exploration of that question has on recovery. One of the most influential of these studies involved 29 full-time patients at the Rehabilitation Institute of Chicago. They were aged from 16 to 35. All had become quadriplegics or paraplegics in serious accidents, victims of the type of random calamity that could befall any one of us. Among the group were 11 car crashes, 6 diving accidents, 4 shootings, along with a private plane crash, a motorcycle accident, a hang gliding accident, a tumble down a flight of stairs, a dive into a haystack, and a high school football tackle. There was also a victim of a falling beam of farm machinery and another person hit by falling machinery. Each case was in itself a rich story of luck, fate, chance, and sliding doors. The researchers interviewed each patient along with their doctors and carers to get a sense of how well or otherwise they were coping with the aftermath of their accident. Every single patient had spontaneously asked themselves, why me, as soon as they were able. The answers fell into 6 categories: predetermination, probability, chance, God, deservedness, and re-evaluation of the event as a positive. The most popular answer was that God had a reason and the person had to trust in that reason whether or not it made sense to them. Putting the tragedy down to chance was also a very common explanation, along the lines of it was just a freak accident that could have happened to anybody. There was a fascinating correlation in this study between the answers to why me and the ability to cope. The people coping best answered in a way that indicated they believed they couldn't have avoided the accident and ultimately that it was their fault, not somebody else's fault. For example, one patient who was managing well said, "It was bound to happen eventually. I've been driving for 15 years. You know, eventually somewhere there's always a fatal accident around." If the activity was something that the person chose to do freely and regularly, like, say, sport, they were inclined to see the accident as something that could have happened to anyone and that they were simply unfortunate. The people who coped the worst were those who were injured doing something that they normally wouldn't do. For example, they had accepted a lift in a car when they normally got public transport home because they saw the accident as something that they could have avoided and they found it hard to stop ruminating on the if-only scenario. The brain couldn't file the event away. Poor coping also correlated with blaming somebody else for what had happened. Among the worst copers was the sole person who had not been able to come up with an explanation or any answer at all to the why me question. It seems that almost any explanation at all, even one as odd as the devil got into God that night and made God do something wrong, which was one of the patient's offerings, is better as a coping mechanism than no explanation at all. Any story that allows the brain to maintain the illusion that there's an underlying order and meaning to our existence helps with recovery. When I met Stuart Diver, he said something that was very vulnerable and made me sad. He said, "Nobody says this to my face, of course, but I know that everybody says it behind my back. They all say, 'Oh, geez, who'd sign up to be the third Mrs. Diver?'" He said, "I think that myself." It's this idea, and I've had people say it to me about Stuart Diver, "Oh, geez, that poor bastard, he must be jinxed." Now, I know that there is no such thing as a jinx, so I rang up the Australian Bureau of Statistics and I said, "Can you please help me calculate the odds that Stuart Diver's future third wife will die before him? I want to test the idea that he's jinxed." They've now got my number on permanent block. They were fantastic. It was really complicated. Stuart lost one wife in an incredibly rare freak event, something for which nobody could possibly blame Stuart Diver himself. Once the landslide was in his past and he remarried, his odds of becoming a widower reset. Unfortunately, Stuart then had the misfortune to lose his second wife to something comparatively common, breast cancer. For women aged 45 to 54, breast cancer is the number one killer, annually claiming one life in about 4,000 in Australia. So it was unusual, very unusual, for Stuart to lose his first wife in a landslide, but it was sadly ordinary to lose his second wife to cancer. You might be thinking, "Well, hang on, I still reckon losing two wives by the age of 44 is pretty weird." Well, you're right about that. It is unlucky to be twice widowed by that age. In the last census of the Australian population, there were more than 8 million adult men. Among them, only 6,000 or so men of Stuart's age were widowers. If twice widowed would be an even smaller sample. But being widowed twice by age 44 is a little like flipping a coin. The loss of Stuart's first wife neither reduced nor increased his chance of losing his second, in the same way that tossing 10 heads does not reduce or increase the chance of tossing a head the 11th time. From the moment you toss the 11th coin in the air, the odds of heads are 50-50, regardless of what's happened before. 10 heads in a row does not cause a tail to arrive next. So the loss of Sally and then the loss of Rosanna were their own discrete events with no causal link between them, certainly not the tie to Stuart Diver. Nonetheless, like the tossing of 10 heads in a row, the more the same result occurs in a row, the rarer the experience. Let's think about the future now and assume that next year Stuart does meet and marry the third Mrs. Diver. We already know that his background is no shield against the poison darts of fate. A happy ever after ending is not guaranteed. But we also know that a tragic past does not make him more susceptible to a tragic future. The third Mrs. Diver will be on her own path, independent of the heads that have been tossed in the past, and so she need not have any special fear because of her association with him. But what about Stuart himself? What are his odds of being widowed a third time? Is it worth getting married again? Let's assume that Stuart marries somebody the same age as him. Of every 100 women aged 47 right now, 2.1 of them will die during the next decade, most likely from breast cancer, suicide, or lung cancer. Even if we add some assumptions about the risks to the third Mrs. Diver's longevity based specifically on being married to Stuart, she might have an elevated chance of dying in a skiing accident compared to the average Australian woman because he runs operations at Thredbo. She might have a higher chance of dying in a plane or car accident with Stuart because he likes travelling, she'd probably be with him. She does not have an elevated risk of dying simply because his first two wives died. There is no jinx. In fact, the next person most likely to be bereaved in the Diver household would be the third Mrs. Diver herself, because the average Australian woman lives a couple of years longer than the average Australian man. So the odds favour Stuart dying before his third wife. Probability and statistics being complicated matters, it took me more than 2 weeks to figure that out. When I finally wrote those paragraphs in a way that seemed to make sense, I emailed them to Michael Wilson at the Australian Bureau of Statistics. "That is a perfect piece of logic," Michael replied, "but even with all that work, I bet people will read it and go, yeah, well, I still think Stuart Diver's jinxed." Lately, I've noticed among friends and even strangers a desire to stop reading or watching the news. The world seems so unstable and dangerous nearly two decades into the 21st century that it's just easier to switch off and watch things that make us laugh or feel good instead of perpetually anxious. I completely understand that compulsion to look away. And so it seems strange to me as I embarked on this book that I was choosing to do the opposite, to walk towards pain and suffering, particularly when there had been a modest measure of it in my own life. Now that I know more about how our brains work, I think perhaps that it was an effort on my part to impose control. I think that subconsciously I thought if I could understand the things that rattled me, perhaps I could regain control of my own life. Even so, at the start of this process, I wondered if I was making a big mistake. I thought maybe meeting the people in these pages and asking them about this kind of stuff would finally tip me over the edge. I thought all these tragic stories might just crush me under their weight and that I would never get out of bed again. Instead, the opposite has happened. It's given me hope. What people can get through is truly amazing. I've been stunned and astonished at what I've learnt, and I really hope that all of you will be interested to read the book and that it will stun and amaze you too. As I said, I didn't know it at the time, but I think when I started working on this book, I was trying to take back control of my own life. I think that I must have thought if I understood why bad things happen or how to prevent them from happening, that they wouldn't happen to me again. I think I wanted one of the people that I met to pat me on the hand and say, it's okay, nothing bad will happen to you ever again. That is, of course, an impossible thing to want. I didn't know at the time I wanted it, but I think that that is what I wanted. Instead, what has happened is that somewhere along the way, I've become far more at ease with not being in control. I accept it instead of fight against it. I take more pleasure at being in the moment. I'm still scared of what I see on the news, and I still dread the next awful thing happening to me, and I don't want it to happen. I'd do anything to duck it. But somehow I feel like with the kindness of others that I'll be able to muddle on. I think we all just seem to mostly just muddle on. I've more come to accept that life is inherently painful, and so therefore it's so important to notice and appreciate the joyful moments. I wish I had some kind of wise scroll to unfurl before you with all the lessons that I've learned, which probably shows that even with all I've looked at, I still struggle to confront the vagaries of fate head on, and I still feel there is a need for lessons to be learned. Nonetheless, if there's anything I've taken away, it's to be grateful for the ordinary days, days like today where we get to gather together and meet other people who love talking about books and love reading. It's to be grateful for ordinary days like that because they're not so ordinary, really. Hindsight can make them quite magical. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please remember to subscribe and rate our channel.